Imagine you are a bank. You've just signed off on a $50 million loan to build this massive state-of-the-art highway in East Africa.
Right, a massive infrastructure deal.
Exactly. And from where you're sitting, looking at the spreadsheet, the deal is just flawless. I mean, the financial model is perfect, the collateral is locked in, and the projections show these incredible returns.
Yeah, it's the classic view from the boardroom, right? The numbers balance, the ink is dry, and it all looks completely binary. To the lenders, it's just a done deal.
Right. But then you step out of that boardroom and into the real world. Say, a week into site preparation, a subcontractor accidentally dumps untreated chemical runoff into a local community's primary water supply.
Yes, a very real possibility.
And suddenly, the local government halts the project. An investigation is launched. And just like that, your pristine $50 million loan is in serious trouble. So, welcome to the real world of development finance.
Exactly. Because the landscape on the ground is never a clean spreadsheet. It's complex, it's messy, and it is entirely unpredictable if you don't know what you're actually looking for.
And that is exactly our mission for today's deep dive. We are taking a really comprehensive look at six dense environmental and social risk advisory modules, specifically the ESRA Foundation Series, modules FO1 through FO6.
It's a lot of material, but it's crucial.
It is. And the goal here is to equip you, the listener, with the working literacy you need to understand the global frameworks governing development finance, not just in Africa, but globally.
Maybe.
And the biggest paradigm shift we really need to start with is this core thesis from module FO1. Environmental and social risk, what we call E&S risk, is not a parallel, soft, or, nice-to-have risk. It's not just something handled by a marginalized sustainability department.
No, not at all.
It is the underlying driver of hard financial risks.
That's truly fascinating here, is the mechanics of how that translation happens.
Right.
I mean, how does a polluted river actually hit a bank's bottom line?
Right. How does that jump from the water to the balance sheet?
Well, the sources outline four very distinct pathways for this financial consequence. You have credit, legal, reputational, and relationship risk. An environmental or social problem, it simply doesn't stay confined to the environment or the community. It travels straight to the ledger.
Okay, let's unpack this. Give me an example of how that actually plays out in practice.
Sure. Let's look at a real anchor case from the materials. There's a tannery operating in Naivasha, Kenya, and they experienced a major effluent discharge incident.
So, toxic waste.
Exactly. Untreated toxic wastewater flowed directly into Lake Naivasha. Now, what happens next? The environmental regulator immediately steps in and slaps the company with a massive fine.
Right.
But they also force them to suspend operations entirely until the facility is upgraded.
So their cash flow completely dries up overnight while their expenses just skyrocket because of the fines and the required upgrades.
Precisely. And suddenly the borrower doesn't have the revenue to service their debt. That is credit risk in its purest form.
Oh, wow. I see.
And, because the bank doesn't want to be tied to a facility that's poisoning a critical water body,
Yeah.
it leads to a forced termination of the loan, a very messy exit from the portfolio. And that right there is relationship risk.
And it scales up to the international level too, right? Because I'm thinking about the Kampala construction project case that was mentioned in the modules.
Ah, yes. That's a perfect example of the other two pathways.
Right.
So in Kampala, there was a tragic worker fatality during site works.
Which is awful.
It is. And that loss of life immediately triggered a government criminal investigation and brought the entire site to a standstill.
So the project just stops.
Entirely. And that is legal risk. But it didn't stop there. The story was actually picked up by the international financial press, and the specific lender financing the project was named in the headlines.
Ouch. So suddenly, investors sitting in London or New York are reading about this specific bank funding a deadly mismanaged project.
Yes, and that is reputational risk. The brand is deeply damaged, and their standing to win future government tenders in that country is severely eroded.
So, if you are listening to this right now, whether you are a project manager, a procurement officer, maybe a legal advisor, or a credit analyst, this framework applies directly to your desk. You can't just outsource this to an ecologist and forget about it.
Absolutely not. It is everyone's business.
But that raises a pretty big question. How do lenders actually measure and manage this risk before the concrete is poured? Because once the damage is done or river is polluted, it feels too late.
And that is exactly where the framework of due diligence comes in. Before a single dollar is disbursed, every project has to be scanned across two distinct dimensions: environmental and social.
Okay, break those down for us.
Well, the environmental dimension is exactly what it sounds like. It's how a business interacts with the natural world. So we're talking biodiversity, pollution, water use, and of course, climate impacts.
And the social dimension.
That is how the project affects people. It covers labor and working conditions, community health and safety, land acquisition, resettlement, and even the protection of cultural heritage.
Okay, but how do they apply that? Because a bank funds wildly different things.
Right. And the central principle governing how a bank manages these two dimensions is a concept called proportionality.
Meaning the bank doesn't treat a massive loan for, say, a corporate office building the same way it treats a small loan for an oil pipeline.
Exactly. The depth of the bank's investigation must match the severity of the potential impacts, not the size of the loan itself.
That makes a lot of sense.
I mean, a $50 million loan to a software consultancy might have a virtually negligible impact footprint. But a $2 million loan to that Naivasha tannery we talked about, that carries exceptionally high risk.
So it's about the footprint, not the finances.
Precisely. Lenders actually classify borrowers into tiers, ranging from tier one, which is negligible, all the way up to tier five, which is very high.
And how do they actually handle a high-risk project once they spot it? What's the process?
It operates like a funnel, using a strict four-step cycle. Screen, assess, mitigate, and monitor.
Screen, assess, mitigate, monitor. Got it.
Right. So you start wide by screening everything in your portfolio. If you catch a red flag, you dive deep and assess it thoroughly. Then you figure out how to mitigate the damage. And finally, you monitor the project for years to ensure the borrower is actually doing what they promised to do.
I want to stop on that third step for a second, the mitigate step. Because the sources lay at something called the mitigation hierarchy, and it's an incredibly strict sequence. Avoid, reduce, restore, offset, and finally, compensate.
Yes, it is very strict.
Okay, let's unpack this. Wait, if a developer knows their project is going to destroy a local wetland, why can't they just jump straight to the offset step?
What do you mean?
Well, why not just buy conservation credits to protect a wetland in another county? Isn't that faster and easier for everyone involved?
It might be faster, but the global standards are entirely unforgiving on this point. Offsetting an impact that could have been avoided in the first place is considered a substantive failure.
Wait, really? A failure?
Absolutely. Think about it this way. Jumping straight to an offset is like crashing your car into your neighbor's house. And instead of paying to fix their living room, you just offer to plant a really nice tree in a public park across town.
Oh, wow. The original damage is still sitting right there. Your neighbor still has a hole in their house.
Exactly. The local ecosystem is still ruined. You only move down that hierarchy when the step above is genuinely, technically infeasible. Avoidance is always the first mandatory option.
So you have to try to route around it first.
Yes. You reroute the power line to bypass the wetland entirely. You do not just pay to protect a different wetland simply because it's cheaper or more convenient for the engineers.
And that ties perfectly into what the modules call the golden rule of timing. The earliest decisions are always the cheapest.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, a borrower's leverage to change a project is highest exactly when the project feels the most abstract, during the feasibility and design phases.
Because it's just paper at that point.
Right. Moving a line on a blueprint costs almost nothing. But discovering a critical habitat during the construction phase, when the bulldozers are already rented and concrete is literally being poured, retrofitting at that stage is astronomically expensive.
Which brings us to the actual rulemakers. We've talked a lot about what banks do, but who is actually writing these standards? If we look at the private sector blueprint first, the sources point to the IFC, the International Finance Corporation, and something called the Equator Principles.
Yes. The IFC performance standards are essentially the operational DNA for development finance globally. If you are lending in emerging markets, this is your baseline.
And there are eight of them, right?
There are eight standards in total, yes. Performance Standard 1, or PS1, is the universal umbrella. It mandates that a project must have proper assessment and management systems in place. And crucially, it is triggered on every single project, without exception.
And what about the other seven standards?
Well, Performance Standards 2 through 8 are conditional. They only trigger if the project actually has that specific type of impact.
Like
PS5 for land resettlement or PS6 for biodiversity conservation. If you aren't moving people or endangering wildlife, those specific standards stay dormant.
So earlier you mentioned that lenders categorize projects based on impact severity, not loan size. the modules give this really fascinating example of this. A 50-megawatt solar facility planned near Marsabit in northern Kenya.
Ah, yes. A classic case.
Now, if I'm a credit analyst, I look at that and think, well, it's renewable energy. It's a relatively modest footprint. No towns are being bulldozed. That's got to be a low-risk Category C project, right?
And that is the most common trap analysts fall into. You're only looking at the environmental dimension.
Hmm.
You know, the carbon offset, the clean energy. You have to look at the social dimension as well.
Okay, so what was the social catch in Marsabit?
That specific solar farm design required fencing off 200 hectares of communal grazing land. And in doing so, it would permanently block seasonal livestock migration routes that Borana pastoral communities have relied on for generations.
Ah, I see. So it's not just about carbon emissions or chopping down trees. It's about fundamentally disrupting an entire community's livelihood and economic survival.
Precisely. And because of that disruption, the bank has to trigger Performance Standard 7 for Indigenous peoples, which requires free, prior, and informed consent in Performance Standard 5 for economic displacement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Suddenly, your seemingly harmless renewable energy project is categorized as a Category A high scrutiny project. It requires the exact same level of caution and assessment as a massive hydroelectric dam.
That makes total sense when the IFC itself is lending the money. But the modules also talk about the Equator Principles, which is a framework adopted by over 140 commercial private banks worldwide.
Yes, EPIV is the current iteration.
Right. And here is where I have to push back a bit. If the Equator Principles are purely voluntary and there is no global police force ready to issue fines if a private bank breaks them, aren't they just a paper tiger? I mean, what gives these principles actual teeth?
That is a crucial question, and it's one a lot of people ask. What gives them teeth is a mechanism called the Independent Environmental and Social Consultant, or the IESC, and the resulting Equator Principles Action Plan, known as the ESP.
Okay, that's a lot of acronyms. How does that work in practice?
Well, before a commercial bank will close a major project finance loan, they hire this independent consultant, the IESC, to review the borrower's plans.
So an outside expert comes in.
Exactly. And the consultant identifies all the gaps between the project's design and the IFC standards. They then write up a list of mandatory actions the borrower must take to close those gaps. That list is the ESP.
Okay.
And here is the kicker. That ESC is written directly into the loan agreement as a binding legal covenant.
Wait, really? So it's not just a polite recommendation?
Not at all. Missing a major environmental reporting deadline in the ESC is treated with the exact same severity as missing a financial interest payment.
Oh!
Yes. It can literally trigger a default event. Furthermore, the Equator Principles navigate global differences through a critical distinction called designated versus non-designated countries.
Right, I saw that in the notes. What does that actually mean for a project, say, in Africa?
In designated countries, which are mostly high-income OECD nations with incredibly mature, well-funded regulatory bodies, the Equator banks allow the local law to be the primary standard.
Because they trust the local authorities.
Exactly. The assumption is that the country's own EPA has it handled. But in non-designated countries, which includes almost all African nations, the IFC performance standards step in to act as the primary benchmark.
Why the distinction? Is it just about the laws on the books?
Not always. Because in many emerging markets, the local laws might actually look great on paper, but the regulatory bodies lack the capacity or the funding or the personnel to properly enforce them. The international standards act as a vital safety net when the local net has holes.
Okay, so that thoroughly covers the private sector and commercial banks. But what happens when the borrower isn't a private company, but a sovereign government?
That's a different landscape entirely.
Right. Say a national ministry of transport taking out a massive loan to build a cross-country railway. A state government isn't going to just let a commercial bank dictate terms to them. Do they get a free pass?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
No free passes. When we are dealing with sovereign spending, we shift to the frameworks of the major multilateral development banks, primarily the World Bank, and very crucial for our context here, the African Development Bank, or AFDB.
Let's start with the World Bank. The sources highlight a massive shift they made recently.
Yes. In 2018, the World Bank completely overhauled its approach. They replaced their old piecemeal safeguard policies with a single coherent environmental and social framework known as the ESF.
Which has 10 standards, right?
Yes, it's a massive piece of architecture. But the most revolutionary innovation in that new framework was something called ES10.
And what does ESS10 actually require a borrowing government to do?
It made stakeholder engagement and information disclosure a standalone, mandatory requirement across the entire life cycle of a project.
Why is that revolutionary? Didn't they talk to people before?
Well, historically, a borrower might hold a single mandatory town hall meeting to just check a box right before the bank's board approved the loan. And then the community would literally never hear from them again.
Oh, I see. Just going through the motions.
Precisely.
Yeah.
ESS 10 ended that. It mandates that a grievance mechanism must remain operational from the day the project is announced until the day the final contractor packs up and goes home.
So communities actually have a permanent line of communication to report issues. That's a very big shift. But for practitioners actually working on the continent, the module suggests that the African Development Bank's Integrated Safeguard System, the ISS, is the framework you're going to bump into the most. Why is that?
Structurally, the AFDB's ISS is unique because it applies to both sovereign governments and private sector borrowers.
Oh, so one rulebook for everyone.
Exactly. You don't have to switch rulebooks depending on who you're lending to. But more importantly, the ISS is specifically designed around three continent-specific pressures that African projects face.
What's the first pressure?
Capacity asymmetry. This goes back to what we discussed about local laws. You might have an international bank with an entire floor of PhD environmental scientists reviewing a project.
Right.
But the local government regulator reviewing that exact same damn project might literally be three overburdened officials sharing a single laptop. The AFDB's framework is designed to bridge that massive gap in technical capacity.
That makes total sense. You have to work with the reality on the ground. What are the other two pressures?
The second is regional integration. Africa's future relies heavily on transboundary infrastructure, multi-country highways, regional power pools, shared water resources. The ISS is built to handle projects that cross multiple legal jurisdictions.
And the third?
The third pressure is a very heavy, urgent focus on climate adaptation, recognizing that Africa is disproportionately vulnerable to climate shocks.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If we look at the reality of how massive infrastructure gets built today, nobody funds a billion-dollar project alone.
No, the numbers are just too big.
Exactly. Co-financing is the absolute norm. So it sounds like we have multiple traffic cocks standing on the exact same highway. What happens when a single hydroelectric dam is co-financed by the AFDB, the World Bank, and a syndicate of Equator Principles commercial banks? Whose rules do they actually follow?
It's the ultimate headache for a project manager, I can tell you that. But when you have parallel safeguard regimes overlapping like that, there's one golden rule. The most stringent provision applies.
Really? So it's a race to the top?
Exactly. If the AFDB standards on, say, labor and working conditions happen to be stricter than the World Bank's on that specific issue, the AFDB standards become the design ceiling for the entire project.
That sounds complicated to manage.
Oh, it is. Harmonizing all these different requirements into one single workable action plan is probably the greatest technical challenge a practitioner faces on a co-finance deal.
So what does this all mean when things inevitably go wrong? We've talked a lot about the rules, and the frameworks sound incredibly robust on paper. But as we all know, a standard is only as strong as what happens when it is actually broken.
And this brings us to the critical concept of accountability. What the data shows us across decades of development finance is that most catastrophic failures aren't caused by bad standards or unknown rules.
What causes them then?
They are almost always failures of implementation and supervision.
You mean people just ignoring the rules?
Essentially, yes. A brilliant environmental and social management plan, an ESMP, is drafted, approved, and then tossed into a drawer in a site office where it gathers dust.
It's a paper exercise.
Exactly. Community grievances are filed but ignored by the site manager. Contractors are hired, but their contracts lack any enforceable safety clauses, so they operate recklessly to cut costs.
And when those ground-level failures happen and communities are harmed, who can they actually turn to? I mean, if the borrower is a massive government ministry and the lender is an international bank, a local farming community seems completely powerless.
Historically, they were. They had nowhere to go. But that is exactly why independent accountability mechanisms were created.
What are those?
These are independent bodies attached to the major banks designed specifically to hear complaints directly from affected people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The IFC has the CAO, the Compliance Advisor Ombudsman. The World Bank has the inspection panel to investigate rule breaking and a dispute resolution service for mediation. And the AFDB has the Independent Review Mechanism, or the IRM, which combines both problem solving and compliance review.
But, I mean, are these mechanisms just glorified suggestion boxes? Do they actually have the power to change anything?
They have completely upended the legal and reputational landscape. Let me give you the most striking example. The landmark Jam v. IFC case. This involved the massive Tata Mundra power plant in India.
What happened there?
There was a catastrophic categorization gap. The lenders failed to recognize that local fishing communities would be heavily impacted by the plant's thermal discharge.
So the hot water killed the fish?
Yes. It led to massive environmental destruction and economic ruin for thousands of people. The community utilized the CAO initially, but eventually they took the IFC to court in the United States. And in 2019, that case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wait. They took the World Bank Group to the Supreme Court?
Yes, they did. And the Supreme Court ruled that international financial institutions no longer enjoy absolute legal immunity.
That is massive.
It changed everything. They can be sued in domestic courts for the commercial projects they finance. That ruling permanently changed the calculus of development finance. Lenders can be named. They can be held legally liable.
That is staggering. It completely shatters the idea that these massive institutions are untouchable. But do we see that kind of impact closer to home here in East Africa?
We absolutely do. Look at the Kapenguria Makutano case right here in Kenya. Over 500 community members in West Pokot were facing the threat of dispossession and severe environmental risk from an imposed, poorly designed sewage project.
And they felt they hadn't been consulted.
Exactly. They felt they hadn't been meaningfully consulted at all.
So what did they do?
They used the AFDB's independent review mechanism to file a formal collective complaint. And the IRM didn't just log the complaint. They deployed investigators to the ground.
And what did they find?
They found that the project was indeed in non-compliance with the bank's safeguards regarding consultation and resettlement.
And did the bank actually fix it or just apologize?
No, they fixed it. Because of that investigation, the bank fundamentally altered the project and relocated the sewage facility to an entirely different alternative site.
Wow.
The community successfully avoided physical displacement. We're talking about real, tangible remedy here. It proves these accountability mechanisms are not symbolic. They are powerful tools for justice.
Hearing all this, I have to admit, it sounds absolutely terrifying for a non-specialist.
How so?
Well, if I'm just a mid-level procurement officer who accidentally forgets to include a specific worker safety clause in a subcontractor's agreement, or if I'm a finance officer who doesn't realize an ESEP reporting deadline was missed, am I personally creating international legal exposure for my entire institution?
This raises a profoundly important question, and it is exactly why the FO3 module was written for this series. E&S risk does not just live in the sustainability department. It lives on everyone's desk.
Right.
Non-specialists hold the frontline risk. The procurement officer who hires an unvetted contractor is creating a massive unmanaged liability. The site manager who dismisses a community complaint about dust or noise is basically setting a timer on a bomb.
Because it escalates.
Exactly. An unanswered community grievance log today is the CAO or inspection panel investigation of tomorrow.
So let's recap our journey today. We started with a fundamental shift. E&S risk is financial risk. It impacts credit, legal standing, relationships, and reputation. We saw how it's mapped globally by the IFC performance standards, applied by over 140 commercial banks through the Equator Principles, and managed at the sovereign level by the World Bank and the AFDB.
A very comprehensive architecture.
And crucially, we learned that these standards are strictly enforced by independent accountability panels that have very real teeth.
And as we look to the future, I want to leave you with a provocative thought to mull over.
Okay, let's hear it.
The sources note that we are standing on the edge of a massive, unprecedented wave of climate transition finance. Trillions of dollars are poised to flood into Africa over the next decade to build green infrastructure. And the urgency of the climate crisis demands rapid, incredibly fast deployment.
So it's a tension between speed and safety.
Exactly. Will the rigid, most stringent applies rule hold up under these emergency do-or-die timelines? Or will the sheer volume of co-financed climate capital finally force the international community to abandon their competing frameworks and create a single, universal global standard just to get the turbines and solar farms built in time?
That is a massive question, and it all comes back to the document sitting on your desk right now. I highly encourage you, the listener, to look closely at your own project ESMPs tomorrow morning. Don't just file them away in a drawer.
Read them.
Exactly. You are now equipped with the literacy to actually read them, to navigate this incredibly complex world of E&S finance, and to spot the risks before they escalate into global headlines. Because as we've learned today, a multi-million dollar loan is never just a clean spreadsheet. The landscape is complex, the impacts are real, and the numbers only truly balance when the people and the environment are protected.